Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. I'm Tandy, and I'm your host this evening or today, whenever you're listening, and I'm joined by my good friend, Christina. And today we have an amazingly special guest. We have got the esteemed Martin Cornell, beer historian, multi-award-winning author, who's been discovering and writing about beer history, well, since well before Christina and I were born anyway. His blog, Zethophile, is one of the most popular beer blogs in the world and keeps readers like us engaged with each new revelation about our favorite tipple and its convoluted history. We also know that Martin is working on a brand new book, or has just finished a brand new book, and we'll certainly talk about that as we go throughout our conversation. So welcome, Martin, and hello, Christina.
Hello.
And just a friendly reminder to those listening or watching home that you can catch the Beer Ladies on all the different social media platforms. We are at Beer Ladies Pod on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, and even on Mastodon, sometimes on TikTok. We've been a bit lax there. I apologize, it's my fault. But we'll regular scheduling will be resumed soon enough. Okay, folks, so let's go around the houses now and talk about what are we drinking tonight. Martin, as our guest, we'll go with you first. What are you drinking?
Okay, well, I'm drinking Adnams Southwold Bitter. Adnams, I'm currently living in a tiny little coastal town called Cromer, which is in Norfolk, and Adnams is around the coast in Southwold, probably about 40 miles from here, so it's a perfectly suitable. It's always been one of my favourites, absolutely classic British bitter. Look at the colour of that gorgeous dark amber colour. And I am drinking out of a very old-fashioned style of pint beer glass, now known as the Lantern beer glass, which is a 10-sided glass. I think these are really lovely. I think they really show up the colour of the beer. I'm going to try and turn the light on here. Hang on.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Look
at that. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's faceted. Yeah, it's faceted mm-hmm. because of the size.
I think it's worked really well for displaying the colour of it. The dimple glass does the same thing. You know, people find the dimple terribly old-fashioned. I think that if you look at the colours in a dimple glass in a well-lit pub, you know, the colours of the beer, particularly these amber-coloured beers, it shows it up really well.
Yeah. I actually like the handle on that glass that you've got. Instead of it just being kind of straight round, it's got like a little raise or a rise before it goes down. Yeah. I think that's easier for the fingers too.
Well, the classic way of holding them is like that. You don't have like that because, as somebody once said, supposing the handle fell off, then you've lost your beer.
So, I actually thought it was the other way around. And I thought that the reason that you'd hold it by the handle and not the glass was to not warm up the beer overly, you know, but that's probably a myth, you know.
I mean, yes, it does. There is the danger of warming the beer up, but it's the way that I feel comfortable holding it.
Fair enough. All righty. Christina, what have you got tonight?
I have brought the Rye River Brunch Baltic Breakfast Porter. And it's a mouthful. It's the porter, and there's a reason I brought that, and we will explore that in a little bit. Specialty Canadian maple syrup, locally roasted coffee. Yeah, it sounds like a breakfast in a can. I'm interested to see how the maple syrup works with the coffee and the porter flavor. So that's really interesting. Quite a lot going on here. Yeah, sounds pretty cool.
I've had that beer actually, and I really enjoyed it. I wasn't sure about it just because it did sound like it was going to be a lot on top of a lot, but actually I thought it was quite nice. Now, I have got almost a diametric opposite. I've gone Timothy Taylor's Landlord, pale ale, the classic pale ale, you know. So in honor of Martin, I've, you know, besides the fact that we'll explore a little bit about porter and the history of porter and stout, Martin, the way that I've known you and your work, I learned about your work through IPAs, you know, the myth busting around IPAs and pale ale. So I've in fact got a Landlord pale ale. I've also got a proper job IPA just in case we go into a second beer. So, you know, you never know.
I really hope that you have better luck with your Tim Taylor's Landlord than I did. I took, am I allowed to mention a rival podcast here?
Of course,
John Holt invited me when I visited New York a few years back, and John Holt invited me to appear on his podcast. And as you probably know, he likes guests to bring along a couple of beers and they taste them completely blind. And I thought, well, I'll take Tim Taylor's. And I also took a beer you may know. It's from what was then my local brewery in London, Twickenham. Fine ales, and they brew a very lovely kind of cross between a bitter and an American pale ale, which they call Naked Ladies, which is named after a set of statues of they're called Oceaniads. They're basically huge marble naked women on seahorses, and they're a local landmark and everybody loves them, and they're known as the Naked Ladies. But of course, I'm afraid the guys in New York couldn't handle this name at all. They thought it was appalling. But the worst problem, the problem was with the Tim Taylor's Landlord, because we took the top off the Tim Taylor's Landlord and it was skunked.
Oh,
and
I thought, no. I don't believe
it. It was instantly, obviously skunked. And I thought, how can I pick? I was in brown glass. How did it get skunked? I've no idea. So that was desperately embarrassing. It's very hugely prestigious. Not as prestigious as yours, obviously, but quite prestigious. and then with a skunk to beer. But I mean, at least it was, you know, at least they were able to say, we recognize it's a skunk. So they were able to show that, yeah, they know what a skunk beer is.
You know what? Tell you what, at least it gets you a good story.
Yeah.
Unfortunate for the beer. Although, I mean, I've had Timothy Taylor in the bottle a few times before, but I've had it on cask as well, which I really enjoy when you can find a good cask. You don't get them here much.
It's a lovely, lovely beer. It really, I think it deserves its rankings as probably one of the top five, I would think, cask beers in Britain. It's absolutely superb beer. And I would certainly, as you say, the problem now is that it's so widely available that often you find it's not as well looked after as it should be. If you get it on form, it's cracking.
Nothing quite like it. I got very excited visiting London. I don't think I was there in the last year, but somewhere there. And one of the pubs I went to, no idea which it was, but they had a lot of the Timothy Taylors on cask. And I was like a kid in the candy store. And I was like, right, that's it. I'm sitting down at this pub and I'm going to have each and every one of them. And I'm going to make notes and I'm going to put them on Untapped and I'm going to do all the beer nerdy things. But I had a lovely time. I really do enjoy it. It's a pity you don't see cask that much here in Ireland. Hey, Christina, not much at all.
No. Mm. You can get it at Wetherspoons.
Mm.
And that's really one of the only places.
Yeah.
It does need people who know what they're doing, who know how to look after it, got the experience in it. You know, I was speaking at a conference in Virginia in October, and while I was over, I tried to sample as many hand pump beers as I could find in various places. And most of the time, and particularly I was trying what was styled as bitters.
Mm.
Again, just not quite getting it.
I mean, there's definitely an art to it, and I think a lot of it is on the, you know, the pub itself and the cellar master or whoever looks after that beer. And I'm still trying to learn a little bit about hand pumps and casks myself, but it seems to me like you can't just take any old beer and you can't brew it as if you were going to store it in a keg and force carbonate it and store it for months on end. You know, there's really a whole art form to it.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with lots of cask beers is that they all handle differently. So and you had the experience of handling something like Landlord and know how that's going to differ from, you know, London Pride or Adnams or whatever, and to know that you will need to leave one for several days maybe, but another one you can really tap straight away and so on. And it's only, you know, an experienced cellar man or woman will be able to do that. Somebody that only deals with it occasionally and isn't really used to it, you know, they won't have that experience. And they won't be able to deliver that prime product.
Indeed. It is a bit of an art, that one. So, Martin, how did you get into beer at all, let alone writing about beer?
it was very strange because I was 14 years old and in a pub garden with my father in Kent, down in the southeast corner of England, and he handed me this. It was a lovely sunny day. He handed me this pint of beer and said, "Try that, son, I think you'll like it." And I took a sip and I was just bowled over by the hoppiness and the flavors and everything else, and I thought, this stuff is great. And it was almost certainly, and sadly now vanished, brewery called Fremlin's. And being down from Kent, they really do went for very hoppy beers then. And I'm sure that's what it would have been. So I, from a very young age, I discovered I liked beer. I'm a journalist by training and career. And I tried to stay away from having very much to do with writing about beer because I didn't really want to mix my kind of professional life with my pastimes, my enjoyment of beer outside work and outside writing about it. But then I knew I was a member of the campaign for Real Ale, and I knew the guys that were putting together a beer guide, a local beer guide in Hertfordshire, which is where I grew up and had my first job as a journalist. And they said, "Oh, we've got a few pages blank at the back of the guide. Can you write us something?" And I said, "Well, what shall I write about?" And they said, "Well, how about a history of brewing in the local area?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, that should be easy to do, easy to research." And it turned out to be not that easy to do. I found I enjoyed doing the research. I enjoyed finding out the stories about these breweries that had disappeared and what had happened to them and why it happened and so on. So that got me into doing the beer history stuff. And it all kind of spread out from there. And then I discovered, as I got more into it, that I found that the thing about beer history, as Christina would know, is that it can be divided up into basically mostly generally business history and technological history, but there was very little about product history.
Right.
There really wasn't much talking about, you know, people would talk about the growth of porter. I mean, there's some fantastic business history written about the growth of porter. There's some fantastic, you know, technological history written about the rise of the giant vats and all the rest of it. Nobody really talked about how the product changed across the decades and across the centuries.
Yeah.
So I started finding myself getting more and more interested in tracking those sorts of developments, you know, how and why IPA, which is very much a minority drink for expats, became a very popular drink for the middle classes in Britain. How that then transformed itself, because IPA was very much a premium beer. So people started bringing out cheaper versions, and that was turn it into bitter ales. But at the same time, while you've got that going on, you've got porter is now declining. Well, why did that happen? Well, how do these changes in taste take place? What influences them? What drives the changes in the popularity of a particular product, and why? How and why does it lose its popularity? But it wasn't in Britain. It wasn't IPA that was replacing it. It was mild ale. So IPAs carried on as a minority drink right the way through to the 1960s in Britain. And in Ireland, of course, it's something different again. Porter came in and very much stayed as, the universal drink, porter and stout. Bitter didn't really get in. Mild, you can discover some references to mild ale in Ireland, but they tended to call it sweet ale, interestingly. Suddenly, in Britain and in Ireland, at more or less the same time, we finally start doing what every other country has been doing for nearly 100 years, and drinking lager.
Yes.
How or why does that happen? I find these kind of sociological things going on in the history of beer absolutely fascinating. And it's not, I keep trying to say this to people, it's not really so much the beer as the sociological implications, the sociological changes that take place. And trying to work out what drives them, what's going on. There don't appear to be too many answers. One of them is that it's very often not one individual changing their tastes, but a cohort thing. So you'll find that as new drinkers come in, they're not drinking what their father drank, they're not drinking what their grandfather drank, they want something new. Yeah. And very often you find that the rise in one drink and the fall in the other drink is almost exactly matching the cohort changes, because every year 2% of drinkers die and another 2% come in who are brand new drinkers standing there at the bar. They've just turned 18 or 21 or whatever your drinking age is. And so what you saw happening in Britain, for example, mild ale was hugely popular. At some breweries were producing 90% of their product in the 1940s, 1950s was mild ale, and then it falls off a cliff at the end of the 1950s. And the reason for that is that all the mild ale drinkers are dying, and all the young kids coming in, they're now, some of them are drinking bitter, more and more of them are drinking lager. I'm sorry about that. I'm just like being, you've got 20 minutes of. Oh my god! But that's kind of, so that's how my interest in beer history developed, and how I got really into being more and more interested in the history of styles and tastes, and interested in all that kind of sociological stuff around taste and around changes in taste.
That's very cool.
Interesting as well, the business stuff and the technological stuff. But what I try to do now is to make sure that there's at least as much focus on the product, which I think was missing for a very, very long time, as much as the other things that have traditionally been, the kind of stuff that academics in particular have concentrated on.
It is interesting how the trends will kind of, come in and out of fashion, so to speak, and I think you nailed it there, where you don't really drink what your parents drink, you almost as an act of defiance you will drink something else, and maybe you'll come around in your old age, but these things shift and change. It's interesting.
And the fascinating thing about that is that implies, because it's happened with every other type of drink, that lager will have its day one day, that lager will stop being the dominant type of beer. And what will replace it? I don't know. I think it may be a much more flavor-oriented type of lager. So we won't. So people I think are now looking for flavor in their beer. They've had it out of American IPAs, American pale ales, and they're looking for that across the board in their beers. And I think that's going to be I suspect that is going to be the thing that will drive change in the beer industry. But if I could predict, I'd be a very rich man.
I sort of made a half-hearted prediction somewhere at the beginning of the year or end of last year that we might see not so much the tastes for lager dipping, but the craft brewers sort of moving away from extremely hoppy or extremely, let's say, complex or flavorful, you know, all these like really big, heavy beers, only, and not because people don't like them, but because ingredients are really expensive. And it's interesting to see how the economic factors will also potentially change brewers' appetites for brewing specific beers, and therefore shaping also the market for what people are interested in. I think that a lot of people are enjoying lagers again, but I wonder what it is going to be. You know, what is the next big style going to be that is not an overwhelming sort of sour pastry dessert stout IPA thing? You know, what's going to be the next simple style that's relatively cheap to manufacture?
Yeah, and I would also say cheap to purchase. Because that's the other thing. On the other side of it is we're you know, we've all got, like, we don't have the disposable income that we had. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think I would like to hope that, you know, more kind of more less in-your-face beers are going to be more popular again. The problem, I think, is that we're finding, even in a country like Ireland, which, of course, where the pub has been solidly the place where you drank, there is much more drinking at home, and people like to have a big hit at home that you're not necessarily looking for in the pub. So that's going to encourage brewers to give people that big hit. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I like a big hit occasionally. There's nothing wrong. I had a very lovely sour fruit beer yesterday from Poland, and it was absolutely terrific. And that was just the one beer I wanted all evening, and that was fine. And but as you know, I still think there is hopefully a big market for that lovely beer that's going to fuel the chat in the pub, the one that you chatting away and you're thinking, that's a lovely pint, I'll have another one of those, you know, which as far as I'm concerned, is very much the best sort of beer, the one that you just enjoy it lubricating the social event that you're in the middle of.
The sort of beer that you're not thinking too hard about, you're just enjoying, you know, you don't have to overanalyze and really wonder about intentions and star alignment and things about when you're drinking it.
If you sat back, you know, a beer like this, if you sat back and started to analyze it, you could get plenty out of it, but you don't have to. You can just enjoy the moment and kind of unconsciously almost enjoy the depth of pleasure that's in there.
Yeah, because you don't always want to play beer judge. I know. I don't.
No, me neither.
I mean, again, the story I now repeat incessantly. I was a beer judging. It was absolutely fascinating. A few years back, we got down to two beers, and one of them was an Imperial Stout, and the other was a Helles. And it was, you know, bigger contrast you couldn't imagine. This Helles, it was from a little brewery down in South Bavaria called ABK. It was the absolutely perfect Helles. It was utterly faultless, clean, just superb, easy drinking, satisfying beer. And the judges split almost equally between everybody who was saying, but this it's got such great flavors in this Imperial Stout, and the others of us were saying, well, you know, to be honest, it's really not that difficult to brew a great Imperial Stout. You just dial everything up to 11 and away you go.
And let it rest for a year.
To brew a perfect Helles like this is really, really difficult. There is, I don't need to tell you this, you know this, there is nowhere to hide in most sorts of lager, particularly in a Helles.
Yeah.
And it deserved to win just for being such a cracking, faultless, perfect beer. And hopefully, and luckily, we prevailed and we persuaded them that this was the winner, and it won, and it deserved to. I don't know whether you do get it now in the UK. You see it, ABK, Actium Brauerei Kaufberg, I think it stands for. If you see it, drink it. It's lovely, lovely, lovely.
Duly noted.
<It's>, people yeah. look out for it.
Mm.
Coming off the back of like how we decide beers and what beers we drink, I have a question about how do you decide what to write about? Because I am a big fan. I have been reading your beer history work since like I started even thinking about maybe being a beer historian in my early master's days back in the day. And you write about such a wealth of information. I mean, you're just a font of knowledge. How do you choose these topics? Do you, I mean, sometimes I know for myself, I fall into them. Do you feel like a certain calling to them for the blog in particular? How do you pick these things?
It's just whatever comes up and interests me. You know, it's very often it's just something comes along and I think, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. That's intriguing. I must dig more into this. Sometimes you find that want to write something about a particular area and it turns out that there's nothing available at all. I wanted to write about the history of brewing in India. To my astonishment, there's absolutely nothing at all. And what there was completely wrong about brewing under the British Raj in India, which is really quite a big thing. I mean, there were 15 or 20 breweries in India in the 19th century, all run by British expats, mostly in a long line of the foothills of the Himalayas, because once you get up to about 6,000 feet, it's finally cold enough to be able to brew in somewhere like India. And it was a fascinating story that no one had dug into. And so it was great to be able to ferret out something that simply remained uncovered previously. So that I kind of fell into, certainly because it was something I wanted to mention, actually, in the Porter book, the fact that there were huge exports of porter to India, far more than pale ale. Because the British troops, being working class, they were drinking porter. It was only the officers drank the pale ale. But there were also some brewers that had been started in India to try to provide beer to the troops more cheaply rather than having to ship it out pre-Suez, 14,000 miles. and I wanted to tell their story, but as I say, there wasn't anything there. As you know, the great thing now about doing any of that kind of research is how much stuff there has been scanned on the internet. So you can find thousands and thousands of newspapers from literally all over the world. You know, you can sit in your study or wherever and log into Hong Kong Library and read 19th century British newspapers in English in Hong Kong, talking about advertising the beers that are on sale, talking about the attempts to start breweries in somewhere like Hong Kong, you know, which again, nobody had ever written about. So it turns out that there was just a huge area out there that partly because before the internet, it was almost impossible to research this stuff. You know, nobody's going to fly to Shanghai and look up copies of the North China Times or whatever, but it's all scanned on the internet now. So you can do it just with a bit of sitting in your bedroom and with the computer in front of you. I could not have done anything like the stuff I've done if it wasn't for the fact that we are now in the, what are we, in the third decade of the 21st century, and there is just almost too much stuff out there to find and drag out and fill it and then put out in front of people. And yeah. I almost don't care if people read it or not, actually. I'm glad that they do and I'm glad that people enjoy it. It's getting the story together in my own head and putting it down on paper is the thing that I enjoy.
Yeah. I think that's so fun. And tell us then about this upcoming book of yours, the one that's going to be released soon, on Porter and Stout.
Yes. Well, this sprang out of something I did for a project called The Geography of Beer. And I had written about the fact that porter was the world's first global beer. It was the first beer to literally be sold around the world and brewed around the world. So there were breweries on every continent and almost every country making this dark black beer that had started out life, of course, as a local beer for local people in London. It was brewed with hops from Kent and brown malt from Hertfordshire, just to the north of London, and it was very specifically for the local working classes in London, and somehow it became a global phenomenon. So I wrote up, I was asked to write 4,000 or 5,000 words for this project, and I ended up writing 23,000 words. I thought, well, I'll do that, that's too much. And managed to cut it down sufficiently. And then this American academic publisher contacted me and said, have you got any ideas for a book? And I said, okay, well, out of doing this preliminary research for this project, I think there is a story. And they said, fantastic. How long do you think it will be? And how long would it take you to write it? And stupidly, I said, oh, 80,000 words and, you know, 6 months, maybe. And so that was when I found that there was just so much stuff. And I actually got up insanely. I got up to 400,000 words, and it took me 5 years. And I've cut it back now to 300,000 words. And I went back to the publishers and I said, look, you know, what do you think? And they read it and they said, okay, well, yeah, it's long, but we think so. Yeah, we like it. I said, thank Christ, because I couldn't stand. I hadn't cut the thing by, you know, 25%. I just couldn't. I was actually going to have to pay. I thought I'm going to pay someone to cut more out of it, because I just can't do it myself anymore. So that has finally been done. I have finally put all the pictures together for it, and written all the picture captions and divided it up. So it's about, there's I think 9 different sections, covering the geography, and also things on like who were the porters, we talked about the technological changes that happened through the decades and through the centuries, and so on and so forth. And hopefully, it may be out at the end of this year, I hope, possibly the beginning of next year. The problem is, I fear it's going to be really quite expensive. But you know, that's what you get with these big academic books, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
And 5 years of your life.
Yeah. I'm not doing that again. Jeez. Never again. But, you know, hopefully, as I say, it will be, it won't be the definitive book, actually. No, it will be what I want it to be is a book that will inspire people to then go off and do their own research, you know. So, for example, I have written about the history of porter in South America, which is fascinating in its own right, you know, and again, some really interesting kind of sociological things going on there in the way that they presented porter in South American society, you know, without giving too much away of what's in the book. What I hope will then happen is that somebody who can actually speak Spanish and Portuguese, I've been relying on Google Translate for all the stuff I've been doing, will now be able to do a much more thorough history of it based on the kind of framework I hope that I'm able to provide for them, and indicating that there is plenty out there to start researching. So people will go away and expand on what I have done and produce something much more thorough in their own particular areas. So the idea is just to give people plenty of background and encourage them to go away and do it themselves. I mean, it's the same. I was embarrassed to be asked by a Polish brewery at the beginning of this year They said it's Baltic Porter week again, which I think is the third week in January every year. And we would like you to come and talk about Baltic Porter. And I said, well, no, I'm English. Why am I? No Polish person yet has done anything on the origins of Baltic Porter and why Baltic Porter exists in the first place. And so I'm the only person to have done it. So I was flown out there and interviewed and talking in English, obviously, and subtitles underneath. And I kept emphasizing, I said, what I'm hoping now is that you're listening to me talking about it. Off you all go. Search Baltic Porter in all the records that are out there in Poland, who was doing it, what they were doing, how they were doing it. So hopefully that's what it will encourage them to do.
Yeah. We've said often on this podcast that there's a million PhD theses, you know, that could be written on almost any topic that you can imagine about beer. There's just so much to still research and document and discover and learn. It's fascinating.
Well, and I think, and I want to ask this to you, Martin, I think in particular, I mean, there's lots of historians that bridge the gap between the general public and academia, but I think in particular, beer history has an appeal, an absolute appeal to a general audience that not all areas of academic study perhaps do. So how do we as beer historians bridge the gap between being, you know, academically accurate and, you know, disproving the myths and the misinformation while still providing things that are interesting to a general audience in a way that is interesting for them to read? And I think you do that well. What is your thought process on that?
Yeah, it's always difficult because I think it was Stephen Hawking talked about how you he was warned that every equation he put into his books meant another 100,000 fewer sales than he would be making. And I think the same is true with footnotes. You know, you can't give the general public a book full of footnotes; they won't be interested in it. But for an academician, it's valueless without footnotes, unless you are saying where those sources are. You know, how do I know you're not just making this stuff up? So that is difficult. You know, the Porter book will be rammed full of footnotes. It will absolutely be chocking with footnotes. But when I did Amber Golden Black, which was the first book I did on, which is, to my astonishment, the first book that anybody had written about the history of beer stars of any sort. There wasn't a single footnote in it because I wanted it to be a popular book that would be read by people who weren't academically minded and who would be probably put off by a host of footnotes. It's really tricky. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think that the internet now gives us an opportunity to do the two things at once, if we're lucky and if we play it right, that you can have the popular version and you can have the footnoted version at the same time. I have just, do I have it here? No, I don't think I do. I've just done a thing on the history of brewing in India, which is in the local, the latest edition of the Brewery History Society journal, and that's all completely footnoted. I'm hoping to produce that as a short book through Lulu or something like that. That won't have any footnotes in it at all. If you want the footnoted version, it's there. If they don't, and I think it probably will have quite a wide appeal to people generally, particularly in India. I noticed I was ripped off and something I had written earlier on Indian brewing history was popped up in the Hindustani Times, with attributed, and I thought, this is going to be, this stuff on India history is going to be the most ripped off thing I've ever done. I know that, I'm aware of it. On the other hand, if it gets people going out and doing their own subsequent research, that's fine. And I think that, you know, it almost doesn't matter if they're academic or they're non-academic, if it encourages people to research this stuff, that's, you know, my job is done. So basically, I've managed to avoid giving you an answer there because I don't know what the answer is. How you you satisfy the academics who quite rightly demand the evidence for the claims that you're making, but at the same time appeal to people who are interested, who do enjoy, you know, learning about the history of what's in their glass and what's in front of them, you know, who are interested in the fact that, for example, if you say, I'm going to produce an authentic historic porter, okay, which period of history do you are you going to be authentic to? You know, they are fascinated by the fact that, you know, authenticity covers an enormous range of things, you know, from the early 18th century through to the early 20th century, they're all different. And people, dare I say, these ordinary drinkers do find that interesting, but they're going to just glaze over if you then hit them with all the footnotes that back up what you're saying. So I don't know that there is any kind of perfect answer. Let's just try to do the two at once, if possible. We could possibly now use the internet for.
Although I do find it interesting now because, you know, there's, on the one hand, you can be writing a book that is almost the academic source for everything and it's, you know, very well categorized and listed and all. But I like that, certainly what you've done, Martin and Christina, you've done it, but it's going to come in such a way that there's also blog posts that you can extract and almost focus a little bit more about the storytelling of some aspect in a very digestible, shorter form way that doesn't, you know, have the feel of an academic book. I like that you could take the research that you've done and, you know, use it and share it in different ways for different audiences. That's appealing. And for me, who's not super interested in all of the primary sources, I'd like to know that you're correct, but not so interested in where you got the info. But it's nice to be able to see the Spark Notes version sometimes, you know, of something.
Yeah. I mean, I did a thing last year with Ansbach and whatever the name is, Hob Day. They have this great beer out. I don't know if you've come across it, but they're London porter. And they said, we'd like to do a whole series of just weekly things about the history of porter, which no problem at all. So we did. I put together 20 things that were tweet worthy. Then you could click through, and there would be something slightly longer, 4 or 5 bars, expanding on the tweet. And that seemed to be really popular. People really enjoyed it. It wasn't any kind of massive footnote big exercise. It was just giving people, you know, little tidbits about the drink that they had in their hand. You know, they'd see the tweet, they'd flip the beer mat over or whatever.
Yeah.
And it gave them something interesting to ponder as they're having their beer. So, you know, I think that's an entirely valid and worthwhile thing to do. And if 1 in 100 of them then go on and buy the book with all the footnotes, well, fantastic.
Yeah.
I think you can kind of hedge your bets a bit. Like, I know for the books that I'm writing, The Academic and Me, I need to, so I'm not doing footnotes, but I'm doing in-text, like, you know, introducing the source and then having a bibliography at the end, which makes my little academic heart happy. But then also providing the source, but maybe not, you know, the day it was published and who published it and all this stuff that's in the bibliography. So trying to hedge the bets, but it is difficult to kind of keep people entertained while still feeling like you're living up to some level of academic integrity. It is difficult. I'm finding it difficult to navigate no footnotes. But I completely agree with you because I think it just really overwhelms everybody.
And I have tried in the past where possible to indicate, as you say, without being crushingly, you know, boring about where precisely where this fact comes from, to indicate approximately where it's from, so someone interested can then track it down if they want to. So it is to do that, but you do, yeah, as you say, you can't just hammer them with every kind of, you know, little wrinkle about precisely where you got this story from and so on.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, that said, you know, Terry Pratchett, one of my favorite authors, sometimes on his pages the footnotes are longer than the words on the page, which is very funny, but it's a very different genre, of course.
Yeah.
Martin, I wanted to know something. Oh, sorry, Christina, you first.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask, since we're talking about academic integrity and being honest and, you know, citing our sources, on the opposite end of that, I was going to ask you beer myths. What are your maybe most annoying beer myths that seem to follow everybody around still that won't seem to go away?
Oh my goodness, my question is so related, because what I wanted to ask you, Martin, and you can just ponder both, is what was the most controversial or kind of difficult to accept finding that you've published? You know, the thing that got people really riled up.
Well, believe it or not, the thing that got people wound up was way back, it must be 15 or more years ago, 15, 18 years ago, when I first started saying that IPA was not invented by this guy, George Hodson. And in the States, they were absolutely furious at this, you know, because this had been the accepted story for, you know, as long as any of these people have been reading stuff from whomsoever, every single writer repeated this idea that George Hodson had invented IPA, blah, blah. And I turned up and said, no, he didn't. That's just not how it happened at all. It was much more complicated than that. And people got very, very angry with me. And much more angry than they did about the whole development of Porter thing. You know, they seemed to be quite okay when I said, actually, no, Porter didn't develop with this lone hero inventing a way of saving everybody time, blah, blah, blah. No, that's not how it happened. And people said, oh, right, okay, well, that's fascinating. So it was the IPA. The IPA one that really got people upset, but now everybody seems to have calmed down, and they now seem to be quite happy that, you know, the story of IPA was actually, as all these things always are, much more complicated and much more nuanced. And although we all love the idea of the lone hero, no, it didn't happen like that. So that was the one. That was the one that got people most upset. But I keep trying to say to people, I never set out to be a myth buster. I set out, actually, to find the exact details of how these things happen. I was brought up with the idea that Ralph Harwood invented Porter to save people mixing this beer called Three Threads. And this happened in 1722 and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, that's fascinating. Let's go back to the sources. Now we can now look at the newspapers. Let's read all the old things and find out exactly how this happened and what people were saying about it. And of course, there wasn't anything to back this up whatsoever. And the more I dug into it, the more the whole story just fell apart. It was clear that it hadn't happened that way. So I didn't set out to smash the myth. I set out to bolster the story, to get corroboration for the story, to get evidence to back the story up. And when I found that the evidence didn't back the story up, I then thought, oh dear.
New rabbit hole.
let's try to pull together what really happened. You know, and that in itself is absolutely fascinating, because it brings together so many different factors in politics, economics, social forces, business forces, and so on and so forth, that all came together and serendipitously invented this new style of beer. Nobody set out to develop a new style of beer. It just happened from what they were doing in reaction to other forces. They were trying to make their beer more cheaply. They were trying to react to the rise in taxes that was going on. And using cheaper ingredients, but the cheaper ingredients being wood, smoke, malt, meant that they had to then store this stuff longer. They were lowering the strength of the beer. Well, that meant that they had to use more hops, and using a hoppier beer stored for a long time, they didn't know what was going to happen. But the miracle that happened was that the souring elements that would normally affect a beer, Pediococcus and Lactobacillus and so on, were kept at bay by the increased hop usage, which was solely to keep the beer stable because it was now weaker. Mm-hmm. And the age, which was solely so that the smoky tough flavor of the wood, cheap wood malts that they were using would dissipate, combined to produce this fantastic new beer, which they weren't looking to do at all. That's a much, much better story, I think, than putting together beers to taste like another beer, Three Threads. And Three Threads itself, actually, the Three Threads existed. But that's another fascinating story. That was a tax fiddle. I'm sorry if I'm mansplaining here and telling you stuff that you know already. But Three Threads itself is a great story because that was a tax fiddle. Because they didn't have the way of measuring strength of beer, extra strong beer and strong beer paid the same tax. If you mixed extra strong beer and weak beer, then you ended up with something that you now had two barrels of strong beer, but you paid less tax combined than you would do if you'd actually produced those two barrels of strong beer in the first place, as you know, ordinary strong beer. So yes, Three Threads existed. Yes, it's a great story in its own right because of you know, again, this reaction to outside forces on the brewing industry, you know, the influence of tax and legislation on the beers that we drink and the way that beers have developed, again, is absolutely fascinating story, which has sort of been looked at, but not as much, I don't think, as it probably should have been. People didn't really investigate. Even some of the great business histories accepted too easily some of the myths that there were about the reason why things like porter developed. So that's the kind of stuff that there have been plenty of other people. There's a great guy called Ray Anderson, who is a practical brewer and a historian. And when you read his stuff, he was the person that educated me on precisely how porter came about, as a reaction to brewers trying to keep the beer affordable and the costs down. And serendipitously producing this entirely new and fabulous style of beer.
That's so cool. I didn't know actually about Three Threads. So yeah, that's awesome. I
didn't know that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
That's awesome.
Well, it's all in the new book.
Ah, yes. Well, we'll see it there at the end of the year or early into the new year. But
I couldn't resist putting down an entire 6,000 word chapter, because what happened was that in 1802, this a journalist called John Felton wrote a story about the so-called origins of porter, and he was the guy that put together this story about it supposedly being an attempt, the invention of porter being an attempt to reproduce the taste of this beer called Three Threads. But he got Three Threads completely wrong. he didn't understand that it was a tax fiddle, and he thought it was because people liked ale, beer, and he said twopenny. Well, twopenny was ale, and all pulled from three different casks. And this was a bit of a faff for the poor old landlord. And so according to Felton, John Harwood, Robert Harwood. Harwood invented porter to supposedly replicate the flavour of this mixed beer. Completely wrong, completely garbled, completely misunderstanding what was happening. But this story then became, it was plagiarised. I think within months, there were 10 other publications repeating this story, because in the 19th century, 18th century, they just didn't care. They plagiarised stuff now, but even then, you know, regularly. And it rapidly became the accepted story about the origins of porter. And lasted all the way through, was repeated everywhere. I tracked. It was great fun doing this. Because you can now do it on the internet. I tracked the different versions of this story and how it was repeated. You know, and you'll find that somebody would print a version in a paper in Ireland in 1840, and then there'll be another small outburst of people plagiarizing that and repeating it and so on. And so this story became the accepted history of the origins of porter, and was repeated by everybody. Every single book that you will read through to the beginning of the 21st century says that porter was invented to replace three threads. And it wasn't, blow my own trumpet. It wasn't until I came along and said, okay, well, where's the actual evidence for it? There isn't any. The story of how the fake story got about and how it spread everywhere, and it was translated into German, and it was translated into Polish, you know, and all the rest of it, is in itself really quite fascinating. So I've got a whole appendix listing the way the story developed, and people misinterpreted things and got dates wrong and misunderstood and so on. And it's actually an interesting, even though it's totally wrong, it's interesting to follow this complete myth and how it repeated itself and became accepted as the definitive story.
I mean, you're absolutely speaking Christina's language, because there is a bugbear on this podcast, and it was our very first episode. So for those listening at home, if you haven't listened to the whole back catalogue, you've got lots to catch up on. But our very first episode was about the myth of how witches were the original brewers, and all the witch mythology, hats and pots and all the things. And Christina's written about this as well. And it's one of those things where the myth is more interesting than the real story, but it just really took over. And so many publications on it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a saying in journalism, which we laugh at, but it's semi-true. Never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Yes.
So the stories are great, but I was having an argument with somebody on Twitter, a stupid thing I know. and he said, it was the other great myth, of course, is the guys sitting in beer soaked leather trousers to test whether or not
the ale conners.
I mean, it doesn't even make sense. You know, no. If you've got to test if a beer's any good, you drink it. You don't ruin the guy's bench and your own trousers by sitting in a puddle, wet puddle, whatever. Why would you do this? he repeated this. And I said, well, I'm sorry, it's not true. There's no evidence for it, and it doesn't make sense. And he said, yeah, but isn't it just, you know, shouldn't we be repeating it because it's a great story? No.
No.
Don't do that.
The truth is interesting enough, you know, really. Yeah. Although now there is something, Martin, I need you to help clear this up for me, because I've asked Christina a number of times, and I've asked Lisa, our other podcast host, and I've tried to research it, but I think that you're the guy to ask. So I know that the definitions of ale and beer changed over time.
Yes.
Right. So now I think what I'm asking is that, you know, initially ales were unhopped, beers were hopped. And then ales had some hops, but not as well hopped as beers. But when and why did we change the definition, and when did ale become like a family of beer and lager is the opposite family of beer? How did that happen?
I think it's because nobody ever stepped back and kind of looked at the overview of the way that the meanings were changing. So you'll find, there are I think 5 or 6 different definitions of ale through the ages, and they tend to overlap, and they tend to be used sometimes at the same time in the same era. You'll get people using ale in a different sense to the way that somebody else is using ale. And in fact, I found it fascinating when I started digging into this stuff. There had been a consensus among historians that ale, which of course was the original unhopped drink and cognate with earl and so on, and all those kind of Scandinavian and Baltic words, and even in old Russian, apparently, before pivo, the Slavonic languages used a version of the ale word. And then again, the Germanic, strictly Germanic, so German and Dutch, Low German, had beer for reasons which we're really not certain about. Nobody's worked this out. And interestingly, when hops started being used, they didn't change the name of the drink. They carried on calling it beer, even though it was now different from the drink that had previously been, because it now had hops in it. French, of course, as you probably know, French kept cervoir, which was as meaning unhopped ale, and bière as for the hop drink. We attempted to do that in Britain. So until the start of the 18th century, if you talked about ale, you pretty much meant an unhopped drink. By then, the ale brewers, who were separate from the beer brewers, because the technology was different, you didn't need. This is the thing that it took me. You know, this is one of those light bulb moments, and I suddenly realised the whole thing about ale, unhopped ale, is that you never needed to brew to boil your wort. There was no to boil the wort. And as you probably know, in some Scandinavian Norwegian brewing traditions where they don't use hops, they don't boil the wort. Raw ale is what it's all about. And raw ale was exactly what was going on. So it was a technological difference between an ale brewer and a beer brewer in Britain was that one boiled the wort and the other one didn't. But gradually, of course, the ale brewers started realizing that actually there was quite a big economic advantage in using hops. So they started putting small amounts of hops in from probably the 1650s. But a guy called William Ellis was writing about beer. He was the guy that did the London and Country Brewer. He was still saying that you can't put too many hops in ale because it stops being ale. If you use too many. Then the whole thing starts getting very murky because, of course, pale ales started being shipped abroad. But to ship it abroad, you need to put more hops in it. So you've now got pale ales that are quite well hot. So pale ales were overseas consumption was hoppy. Pale ale for home consumption remained unhoppy. And it was those pale ales that seem to be, I mean, I've got no definitive proof of this, but it seems to be those pale ales that were the ancestors, lightly hot pale ales were the ancestors of mild ales in Britain. At the same time, you now have a problem in that once hoppy pale ales started coming back into Britain from abroad, you've got two beers that seem to be the same name but are very different from each other. So that's when the customer starts calling these hoppy pale ales bitter. The brewers don't. And carried on calling them pale ales, even though they were not the same as the pale mild ales that they were also selling. And that's why bottled bitters were called pale ales, because the brewer was putting the name on the bottle. But in the pub, those exactly the same beers were called bitter, because that's what the customer was asking for. Right, so anyway, meantime... we've now, by the middle of the 19th century, we now have ale pretty much meaning mild beer, and beer meant porter and stout. So that was the difference in the 19th century. So it's entirely different in the States, where beer meant lager. So you see, in the 19th century in the States, people talk about beer and ale, and what they mean is lager. And porter, the ale was the porters and the bitters and the Burton ales and things like that. But if they talk about beer, they meant lager in the States. Confused? Yes, we certainly are. So you then get another slow change. And because beer now meant in Britain, beer now meant porter, you now get a change so that by the start of the 20th century, ale meant a pale beer and beer meant a dark beer. Then people just start ignoring all that. And so really certainly the end of the 1920s, start of the 1930s, ale and beer mean, in Britain, mean the same thing. But of course, we didn't have lager at that time. Nobody drank lager. And it's not really, I mean, even in the 1960s, start of the 1960s, lager was only about 2% of sales in Britain, and probably much the same, I would guess, in Ireland. I don't know. But I'm guessing. That's a very brief history, and not too confusing, of how ale has constantly changed its meaning over the past, certainly from the 17th century, when ales stopped being totally unhot and started having some hops put in them. It's changed its meaning through time. But even in the 1950s, you will find... in somewhere like London, if you went into a pub and you said, give me a pint of ale, you'd be handed a pint of mild. And if you wanted bitter, then you'd ask for a pint of bitter and you'd be handed a pint of bitter. So that was still a difference, theoretically, between ale and bitter. Ale,
yeah. And
whatever. So I hope that's answered your question.
It's really interesting because, you know, one of the things when I moved to Ireland was that I saw in some of the older pubs, signs for porters. Sometimes you get porters, lagers, beers, or sometimes you'd get ales, lagers, beers. Sometimes you'd see ales, beers. And the way that I'd always just known beer was that ale and lager are the families of beer. It's based on the yeast, it's based on the fermentation profile, and all of them are beer. So it was just like so fascinating to me that people have different names for things.
What they would have meant by ale and beer would be pale ales and stouts and porters.
Stouts
and porters and beer.
Yeah.
Beers, because they were heavily hot.
Mm.
You know, the difference for a long time was that ale was lightly hot, beer was heavily hot.
Mm.
And so therefore porter fell in the beer family because it was heavily hot.
It was heavily hopped, yeah. So interesting. I like the linguistic shift of all of these terms over time. And if you're not already writing a book of the timeline of all of these things, that would be really cool.
Except that it's irritating to have to keep explaining to people that the terminology changed. When I'm talking about ale here or whatever. And one of the really irritating things is that it's the tradition in archaeology for them always to talk about beer, even though they're not talking about beer. They're talking about ale.
Right.
Yeah, and it gets really confusing.
It's far too late to get them to change.
No. But yeah, it's the same thing with some historians. They'll be talking about beer and it's in the medieval period and you're like, in Ireland? No.
No. Ale at best. That's so fun. Well, Martin, listen, let's not keep you up all night here. But Christina, do you have any final questions before we wrap it up?
I guess my last question would be, what would be your advice to someone who wants to get into beer history?
Find out what your local brewery was and dig out as much of it as you possibly can. Because there will, it's very likely that nobody has really dug into it, and there is now going to be a hell of a lot there to dig into, particularly with newspapers and so on. I've just done a job. I don't know if you've seen it. There's a company called Lucky Lager who do a alcohol-free lager, and they've just taken over a pub in central London, just north of Oxford Street. And they changed it, they've using it to promote their beer. And they asked me to research the history of this pub. So it's an absolutely typical street corner, city centre boozer. And you would think it would have no real history behind it at all. And yet, once you start digging into this place, started in the 1790s. It has all sorts of fascinating stories attached to it, and as does every other pub, I'm sure. Any other pub over about 150 years old, and most of them are, they have fascinating stories, and it's all researchable now because of the resources there are on the net. And the same is true of so many little breweries, that there is so much stuff to discover there would have taken years to plow through newspapers in the past. You could now do it so easily. It's just unbelievable. So there's never been a better time to get into things like beer history. And again, you know, there's so much family history out there now, so available. So many people have done great things, like, you know, recording old graveyards, or cemeteries, going through and writing down all the names and dates and so on. If you want to start doing this stuff, you'll find really quite quickly that there's an awful lot that you can gather in, and the Brewery History Journal will love to see your findings.
That's so cool. Great advice. I like the idea of starting small and starting local, instead of being overwhelmed with some big question about the history of beer. I think that's a great piece of advice.
There's thousands and thousands of breweries out there once upon a time, and very, very few of them have had any kind of real in-depth research done on them. And there are still quite likely to be buildings around. There's certainly going to be pubs that those breweries own that are still in existence. And there's going to be a considerable amount of information now available to be found on them. So away you go.
Well, thank you. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate your company and your insight today, tonight, whenever the listeners at home will be hearing or watching this. But it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about beer, which, as you notice, is something I thoroughly enjoy doing.
Absolutely. Anytime. We can do a round two once your Porter and Stout book comes out, end of the year, beginning of next year. We'll see. We'll tweet it out when we see the news, and that'll be lovely. We'll definitely pick it up.
I should be blowing my trumpet very loudly.
Excellent. We'll keep a lookout for it. And friends at home, thank you so much for listening to the Beer Ladies podcast. We really appreciate you joining us every week, especially when we've got wonderful guests like Martin on. And catch us on the socials, wherever you want to find us. We're on every single social media platform at Beer Ladies Pod or at Beer Ladies Podcast. You can even buy merch or buy us a pint. We always appreciate it. So thank you very much. And good night, Christina. Good night, Martin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank
you. Cool.
Bye.
'Extra' might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.